I had this real interest and passion that I felt like I could not be happy unless I tried. I would be okay, I think, but I don't think I could have accepted giving up. And I think I've learned in life that you can control the effort, but not the outcome.
You had some really excellent messages from your time in space and working with NASA. And the two things that sort of stuck with me were just leadership and teamwork.
When I had my moments of making mistakes and messing up our mission, I knew that my team was still with me. They kept me going, and no one was going to throw me under the bus. And that's a good way to go. You know, if you're going to go down, you're going to go down with your best friends. And that's the way I felt about it.
With all due respect to every person I've ever interviewed for a podcast, I have to say that this might be one of my favorite episodes ever. Like I said, no disrespect, nothing meant by this, but I've never in my life had the opportunity to sit down across the table from an astronaut. And that's exactly the opportunity that I was presented with, and Nationwide really as a whole was presented with when we went to primetime in Houston recently, beginning of February here, and had a keynote speaker, in Houston. Houston, of course, being the home to one of the space NASA headquarters for, many years with the space program. And Houston, we have a problem, being one of those cliche sort of terms that gets used quite often. But, we're in Houston, and figure what better way to tie into the community there than to have a former astronaut join us there for the keynote in Houston at primetime. And that's what we had with Mike Massimino, a guy who, is a retired and former astronaut and joined us in Houston. He's someone that's stayed in touch with the program, has had a recent history of trying to drum up interest among youth in the space program through, TV appearances. He's been a recurring guest on The Big Bang Theory, and has, his own involvement with a couple of, TV programs to try to educate and keep the youth and young children interested in space and educating them around space. But joined us in Houston to talk about things he's learned as an astronaut that can be applied in some way, believe it or not, to the retail community and to local mom and pop shops and independent retailers. So had delivered an incredible keynote, tying in a lot of stories about what it was like to complete two spacewalks and work on the Hubble telescope, avoid a near disaster with the Hubble telescope as he was repairing it and on one of those spacewalks, and just all sorts of stuff about leadership and teamwork and stuff that really hits home. So, I really enjoyed the opportunity to chat with him after that keynote and have him on the podcast. So let's just go ahead and, stop talking, listen to me talk, and let's hear from the astronaut himself. All right, we're back on the Independent Thinking Podcast, and right now coming to you from primetime. I've interviewed a lot of people, and mm-hmm. I've gotten the chance to talk to some interesting individuals, but this will be a first today. So I've never mm-hmm. had the chance to interview an astronaut. So we're here at primetime in Houston, and Mike Massimino, appreciate you first, coming to Houston, coming back to Houston.
Yeah, I like it here.
Yeah, it's a place you called home for a number of years.
Yeah, raised my family here. Yep.
So appreciate you taking the time to join us in Houston and deliver a riveting keynote, a really mm-hmm. excellent keynote.
Thank you.
And now, spend a few minutes with us for the podcast.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, yeah.
So let's start, with that keynote. You had some really excellent messages, that came out of it from your time in space and working with NASA. And the two things that sort of stuck with me, I think, that were sort of the big takeaways right away were just leadership and teamwork and what that means, how much that plays into everything that goes on that permeates through all of NASA and mm-hmm. whether that's, preparing to go up for a launch or all the work that goes on in space while you're in space for spacewalks. So just kind of, how do you recap a 45-minute keynote, right? But, mm-hmm. What are some of the things, the quick points, the takeaways that you could kind of share with us about leadership mm-hmm. and teamwork and sort of what they mean to you?
Yeah, and some of the things that that I learned at NASA to try to share with the group were things like it's a team win or a team loss. You know, you're there to support each other in victory and in defeat, and it's easy to win together, but it's not always easy to lose together. And do you blame your teammates for the loss or for whatever happened, or do you stick with them? And I think that that's what I realized even when I had my moments of making mistakes and messing up our mission. I knew that my team was still with me, and they kept me going, and no one was going to throw me under the bus. And that's a good way to go. You know, if you're going to go down, you're going to go down with your best friends, and that's the way I felt about it. Some of the things that we learned, I think that caring about each other is really important, and things like making sure that you find a way to care for and admire everyone on your team, that everyone should know that if they have a problem, it's not that they have a problem, but we all have a problem, whatever that might be, whether it's at work or even in the personal life. So having that kind of relationship with your group. And when you do make mistakes, you know, understand that that's going to happen, and you don't want those things to happen, but if you need help, ask for it. If you can give help, give it in those situations. But certainly try not to make things worse. That's one thing that I learned. You know, all right, hey, I made this mistake. I don't want to make it worse. And then, you know, don't beat yourself up too badly. Put a time limit on it. It's okay to feel bad about it, but you also need to move on. And can't do anything about a lot of these things when they happen, but you can certainly make it worse, and you can certainly make it worse also by just dwelling on it. So, hey, I'm going to learn from it, and I'm going to move on, and I think that's important as well. And these are all things that I found I needed to do, because if you didn't operate that way, you were going to not be successful. And you got to say you're going to make mistakes. Let it pass.
Sure. And to kind of story tell for a second, you know, you mentioned the mistake in space and kind of you know, how you worked through that during the keynote. But this is where, for those who don't know that are listening to the podcast, you know, this is a mistake where, or a mission where you're up in space working on the Hubble telescope, mm-hmm. a instrument that I'm sure a lot of people are familiar mm-hmm. with. And, you know, you got stuck in a jam. So tell us a little bit about what that the jam you got yourself into, and then how you worked yourself out of it.
We had a very complicated spacewalk, and it was planned for years, even before we were assigned. And when we started thinking about that, we were going to be going back to going to Hubble to do this last mission. Before our crew was there, we started thinking about how we could do this instrument repair. And what we had done up to that point was remove instruments from the telescope or pieces of equipment and put a whole new one in. So, you know, it's kind of like if your alternator goes bad in a car, you replace the car. You know, you don't get a, you know, if the light bulb's out in the refrigerator, get a new refrigerator. You don't go in there and start removing parts from these things. And so that's what it was with Hubble. We would remove big pieces of equipment and put new ones in. We wouldn't try to repair the pieces of equipment in space. And this one instrument, though, we didn't have a replacement for. It was a spectrograph, which could analyze planet atmospheres and do all this cool science, and it had a power supply failure that killed it. But it still, everything was fine except you couldn't turn it on. But it was buttoned up such that it was hard to get to this power supply, and it was 111 small screws that needed to be removed, and launch lock bolts and connectors that were never intended to be ever undone anywhere, even space or on Earth. So we had to figure out ways to do this, because it was buttoned up and launched, and that was going to be it. So we had to undo all that smart guy work that they did to button it up. And the easiest thing was to remove a handrail that was blocking access to some of the screws we needed to get to. And that was going to be easy. It was big bolts. And I tell other people about this. I actually got a call from a crew, and the astronaut crew, a couple months ago. They were working on something called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, and it was a fairly complicated spacewalk. And I got a call from them. You can call the planet. And I was speaking to the guys, and I said, what do you have for us? I said, well, you guys are well-trained, but don't forget the simple things, too. You know, pay attention to everything, because that's what happened to me, I think, is that I was so worried about all the complicated stuff that the simple thing that I was doing, I messed that up. And then luckily, there were four bolts holding this thing in place, and three came out, but one I stripped. And so it was just some way to overcome that last bolt. And we were trying everything. There was no way to get it out, and then the solution came up to just try to yank it off, which might seem simple, just to rip it off, but
right.
It didn't occur to me to do that. It's just something we wouldn't normally do. When you break metal, you create debris. You can't have debris in a telescope. Debris might come and hit me.
Right.
But the solution for that was to tape the bottom of the handrail where it was going to break so that the debris would be contained in the tape.
Man.
And that was a pretty clever thing to do, and it came off with a little bit of force, not too much.
I'm thinking, picturing this happening in space and trying to flip through like an IKEA manual of what it's like to take these things apart. And
that's kind of what it is. We have that. You see, we had our checklist, of course, but we also had something that was called a crib sheet, and then we had a contingency checklist that was for everything that had happened on previous missions. That was a problem. You had a way to get around it that, you figured it out. And then stuff that happened in training, this or that, we got to watch out. And then you would try to imagine everything that could go wrong. Like for the smaller screws I described, we had ways, if I stripped one of those, we had ways to get them out. We had easy outs and bolt head destroyer bits and stuff like that. So we had ways to get, but we thought even I couldn't mess up this handrail. And of course that's what I did. So we had nothing in our crib sheet or in our contingency checklist for this, because this was like really simple. So we couldn't imagine that I would mess that up. And
man,
what I did.
Hey, maybe to your credit, you don't know what sort of impact being in space for as long as that telescope has been. Who knows what could happen to these parts?
Well,
the
truth of it, what happened was, is I was using a big power tool at a high speed. We should have been using a lower speed. There's no reason to, and I spun it at a high rate of speed, and that's what it didn't have time to catch, because the torque, when they did the analysis, these bolts, when they put them in, because they were never coming out again,
right?
Not only did they torque them down, they had washers there as well to help, and then they had glue staking on the threads. So when the post-flight analysis, because when I yanked this thing off, it came home, and they found that the issue was is that one bolt, compared to the other three, that one had apparently more glue on it than the others and required more torque.
Wow.
So we didn't know that, and so it was not going to come out with the settings we had, and instead the bolt stayed where it was. The tool spun inside of the hex head of the bolt and ruined it without loosening it. So that's what happened. But I didn't know that when I was working.
Right.
We would have done something different, right? So, but that was the problem there. You never know. Yeah, who would have imagined?
And relating that back to retail and kind of the nationwide membership is like, mm-hmm. you can't prepare for things. You can prepare for so much, but
yeah.
It's just being able to sort of persevere through those moments and
right.
find solutions and find the fix that works for you.
Yeah, you can't practice everything. And, there's... What I felt like is that there's a list of things that can go wrong in life, and you can imagine them, you experience some of them, but there's some of them that you can't even imagine, and how the heck did this ever happen? And you can't even imagine, it's never happened before, and it's going to happen. And
right.
you just try to, there's a list of those things, and some of them will present themselves to you when you make those mistakes. And so what I felt like is we can't think of everything. We can't be prepared. We can't have a direct solution for everything. But the way we can be prepared to handle everything is to be good at handling problems as a crew and as a team with our control centers. That we know how to attack a problem. We may not have seen this problem before, but we certainly know how to work together to solve problems. And I think that's what life is, right? You're not gonna today it's gonna be something you never would have expected, but. You know what? We have experience of working together, and I know where to go. Nationwide, call them if you're a retailer, get help. Maybe they can. Maybe they haven't seen it either, but maybe they can help you figure it out.
Well, even to kind of, we've been hitting on leadership and teamwork and perseverance from your crew perspective, but mm-hmm. even you personally, you go back to before getting into the space mm-hmm. program, and you were denied a couple times.
Three times. Yeah.
And then you get end up getting accepted, and then I think you said you got medically
disqualified before. That was my third rejection. Was medical.
Right. So yeah. Because of eyesight. So I mean, for you personally, and this was a dream. Reading your book, you talk about how this was a dream of yours from being a young kid, seeing Neil Armstrong and his crew land on the moon to the Right Stuff movie, is that right? Yeah,
yep.
So seeing the Right Stuff and getting that spark to want to go to space.
Yep.
So, I mean, for you personally to persevere through those challenges trying to become an astronaut, mm-hmm. What was that like for you, and lessons did you learn along the way?
Yeah, I think that it was, for me, it was, I think there's a couple of things that are important there. But I had this real interest and passion that I felt like I could not be happy unless I tried. I would be okay, I think, disappointed if I never was selected, of course, but I don't think I could have accepted giving up. And I would have real regrets. As long as I kept trying, as long as I knew that no matter what happened, I was gonna figure out a way to keep trying, that I think that's all I could do. And I think I've learned in life that you can control the effort, but not the outcome. You can't always control what's gonna happen. And Joe Torre, the baseball manager, is a friend of mine. I learned that from him. He told me that one time. He said, he learned that you can prepare and do your best, but you can't always control that outcome. And that's the way it is in sports. That's the way it is in life too, you know. So, but you can certainly control the effort. And so that's what I was going to concentrate on. And I felt like the chances of becoming an astronaut were pretty close to zero. You know, it's very unlikely, especially after getting rejected over and over again. But I knew that the only way that it was, that there truly was a zero probability, was if I gave up. You know, if you give up or you never try, you know what the outcome is going to be. It's not going to happen. It's going to be zero. So as long as you try, there's always a chance, and that's what I was holding on to.
And probably the greatest example of that is, you know, we mentioned the medically disqualified and because of eyesight, and mm-hmm. and then to take, you know, not let that be a hump that you couldn't overcome.
Yeah.
Going to, you know, an eye doctor that you mentioned it only worked with kids.
Only worked with kids. I told her I'd be really immature.
But yeah. Just lower that age level for her.
Yeah.
But, I mean, doing exercise is something, and this is a time, I believe, before LASIK, right? So LASIK
wasn't accepted back then. Yeah, right. No, they had, I don't know if they had it or not, but they had other things. They had radiokeratotomy, and they had something else. I forget what else they had. I don't know if they had LASIK, but they did not accept any of that stuff because there wasn't much experience with that stuff yet. Now they actually do accept LASIK as long as it's stable for 6 months, and wow. You don't even need to do that because you don't have, your unaided acuity is not important. It's just as long as you're correctable to 20/20.
Wow.
So all that stuff went out the window. It was an antiquated rule that was the number one disqualifier of people.
It's crazy.
Even guys I could really see. Well, I remember we were there in groups of 20 at a time when we interviewed. And I was in this group of 20 people that were there that week. And so we would generally meet for dinner because we were coming from different parts of the country. And a lot of military people were there from wherever they were stationed, from around the world sometimes. But you were all there together in Houston. You got to know each other really well, the people in my interview group, because you would see each other as you're going through the process or through the health clinic or whatever, getting tested. You're doing things together. And so we'd always have dinner. We'd always find a place to meet for dinner. And I remember sitting next to this one Navy pilot who was a very experienced pilot, flown off a Navy carrier. I think he was sort of on the senior side, maybe his early 40s, late 30s, something like that. But he was an experienced flyer, and it was something kind of disappointing. I had to go today. He's like, he goes, I can't believe it. I failed the eye exam. And I go, how did you fail the eye? You know, you're a Navy. And at that time, I think the Navy required, he said, because I'm 20/20 my whole life.
Wow.
And I'm still 20/20. I go, so how did you fail? And he said, well, they dilated our eyes something tremendous. They had these really powerful dilation. I think they were for horses. I don't know how they got. I don't think you can give them to regular humans.
Right.
But they would dilate your eye. And for whatever reason, I guess as he got older, maybe a little accommodation of his eye muscles helped with the focusing of bending the. And he could not see 20/20 with his eyes dilated. And they failed him on that. And I was like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, because how the heck does that matter? You know, first of all, right, you're not going to go into space with your eyes dilated. You don't live, you don't walk around. This is an unnormal thing. I think they dilated your eyes to get see better and stuff, but they also rechecked your acuity. And because he couldn't see 20/20 dilated, and then the other thing that made me wonder about it was that once you got picked, if your eyesight decayed, you were still okay. They'd wave it. So, and people wore eyeglasses during spacewalks, and people wore eyeglasses landing the space shuttle, I wore contact lenses during my spacewalks. So it kind of gave me the sense of, like, this is really dumb. You know, that's the other thing I was saying. This is not a good way to go.
This is the hurdle.
It wasn't like I had some kind of illness or something that if I went to space, my intestines were going to explode. You know, this is really stupid. You have people that don't see very well. You know, the guys that, and so why is this? And it was just like, well, we want the best people we can get. Well, really what it was is they had I think the guy that was running flight medicine back then was kind of an old grumpy. I really don't know if he was grumpy or not, but I imagine him this way. And, you know, he was from the days of the pilots and everyone needed to see well because that's how you did it back then. You saw everything. They didn't have any in World War II. They didn't have much in the area of computers to help them find the enemy. And they had to be able to see the other guy during a dogfight. But this was, you know, later on in the 20th century and, you know, by 50 years or so. And Why not use what's available then? And now it's no longer an issue. So,
man, that's crazy. But I have two space questions that I want to kind of end on. That just curious to hear your thoughts on one. You know, you mentioned during your keynote that you were on the last successful Columbia mission to return.
The last one I got to land. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, seeing that, you know, you talk about the. And you also mentioned the fear of going up and seeing the shuttle and sort of how it felt alive and kind of the fear that stokes in you. But, you know, what as an astronaut, a former astronaut and, you know, seeing that happen, what's the reaction knowing that you were on that ship? And I know it's debris that happened beforehand, like anything can happen. But what's kind of the when you see that happen, what's the impact on it?
Part of that story, too, is that crew was assigned to Columbia before we were, and they were STS 107. That's the way we numbered shuttle flights, and they more or less ordered them numbered in order. We were STS 109, so we were going to go after them. And Columbia, when it went through a refurb out in Palmdale, California, at the plant, when it was returned to the Kennedy Space Center for STS 107, there was some issues with it when it got back there. Something strange is like the paint or something had gone that needed to be redone. It was going to delay it to be flight ready longer than expected. Something happened when they were refurbing it. And what they did is they switched the order of the flights because they wanted us to get to Hubble. Their 107 was a science mission that could pretty much happen anytime, but we were going to Hubble and they were afraid of certain things starting to break on the telescope. And then, you know, we wanted to get there first, so they flipped the order of our flights. So we got their spot and they got ours. So I figured that one out like the day after. I was like, holy cow.
Wow.
And we traded seats with them, more or less, spots with them. You know, who knows what would have happened, but that had me thinking too. So it was pretty devastating, but I think about them a lot. I think about my friends all the time. Every day. That day goes by, I don't think about it. I knew them all really well. And three were my astronaut classmates. Rick Cusman was one of my best friends. He was a commander. And Ilan Ramon, I knew he and his family very well. I just saw his son. Me and some of the other. He's an Israeli astronaut, so from us got involved with his foundation in Israel. And as a result of all this, so. We think about these people all the time, and it was a really bad accident. It was a tragedy, but it also you got to keep going. And in some strange way, I felt like, you know, that could have been us, and it wasn't. And I kind of sometimes, I don't know, I have this feeling about my friends that they're still kind of around, sort of it's like. Trying to live the best we can in their honor, because, you know, they didn't get a chance to see their kids get older, and it's been now, how long has it been? It was 03. We just celebrated 17 years ago this happened, and their lives were cut short. And so I felt like, you know, space exploration and the way we live our lives, we need to realize that we owe it to the opportunity to be here to do the best we can every day.
That's awesome, and you know, certainly quite the tribute and well put. But another question I wanted to ask, and this is something you briefly touched on stage with Tom Hickman, our chief member advocate, and something I know prior to coming down to Houston on the call to get to know you, you kind of touched on as well, the impact that being in space, and you were part of two space walks and mentioned the first one, you were very in the zone, wanting to stay focused on, mm-hmm. on the job. But that second spacewalk where you had some time to look around and you see Earth from that mm-hmm. perspective, you see our planet and kind of what that does to you, you know, to see the planet from space and, mm-hmm. you know, not down on Earth like we typically see it. So yeah. or from the, you know, as high as I get it ever mm-hmm. is the 30,000 feet in an airplane. So yeah. I know it's a completely
that's
different.
That's where I'm going now.
I know it's a completely different perspective, but what does that do to you to see the planet in that way?
You see it in its entirety, and you can, as you're going around it, you can see how beautiful it is. From that perspective, I think that for us to truly appreciate our planet, we need to get off of it, which is kind of weird. I think to really see its beauty is you need to observe it from above. I think to really understand it, of the changes that it's going through, and in climate and in migration of people and agriculture, you can tell a lot of what's going on the planet by looking at it from up there. And it gives you an appreciation for the beauty of it, and also the appreciation that is our home. And when you're in space, the only way you're existing is with life support, and you appreciate how well the Earth takes care of us. So we can't mess this thing up. No. I think that
we got one of them.
and I got the permanence of it as I was going around the planet and seeing it, you know, the rotation and the changes in day and night, and looking at the sun and the planet is there a long time before we were. And if we do something to ourselves where we don't, you know, we don't survive for whatever, I don't think that's going to happen, but the planet will survive. I think the planet's going to be okay. I think the planet can heal itself, mm-hmm. and I think we have to keep it good for us so we can still be here for a while.
Fingers crossed on that one.
Yeah,
I think we'll be all right.
I have faith. We'll be all right.
We get one of them, but yeah. One final thing I wanted to do, and I don't know what, so for people that are familiar with Big Bang Theory, mm-hmm. you have a recurring role there.
Yep.
They may know that a certain character that goes to space gets mm-hmm. gets the call name Fruit Loops.
Yeah.
On there. So how do you get these call names?
These call signs come up. They just naturally happen. If you try to give yourself your own name because you want
gonna,
a cool
it's
name,
not gonna stick.
That's not going to happen. that's going to backfire, like it did in the episode of The Big Bang. Yeah. We've had cases of that I've witnessed. That someone that doesn't work. And then guys try to hide their call sign when they show up at a new place. That's another thing. And then they'll, you know, the phone call's not that hard to make. What did you call this guy back in Yuma, Arizona? You know, and so, yeah, you got to be careful with that. But
okay.
For me, I thought I was going to get a call sign that I wasn't too happy about. We were in water survival training, and they had these parachutes that we were hooked up to, and we were coming off the deck of a ship that was very high off the ground. I don't know how high it was, but it was pretty high, 20 to 25 feet off the deck, off the water. And the idea was you would march off this platform, and then you would become, you're getting pulled by a boat, but you'd march, and then you'd get to the end of the deck of the ship. It was a flat, open deck there, and then the boat would pull you, and you would rise in your parachute. Well, the person before me was Stephanie Wilson, who is, I don't know, she was much smaller than I was. And I'm a bigger astronaut, and she was a smaller astronaut. And she went up like Peter Pan. I don't think they recalibrated anything when I stepped in there. And I just went right to the water, and they couldn't get me airborne. And they drug me in the water, and I kept getting airborne like about 5 or 10 feet, and then bang, just kept dunking me and dragging me in the water until they gave up. And then we had to try it again, but it worked luckily the second time. But while this was going on, I guess I looked like a teabag. So one of my crewmates started calling me teabag, and I just didn't say anything.
No.
But then eventually the nickname I got was a nickname call sign that I had my whole life, which is Mass, which is short for my name. So that's what I've been called my whole life.
Cool.
And a lot of people, a lot of my friends still call me that.
Any tie to Top Gun and like the Mavericks and names that they get there?
A lot of the names aren't like cool names, like Maverick
like
and Iceman. And no, we had like my commander, Scott Altman, was Scooter because of his name. And I think he had other ones that he didn't like. He actually flew in the movie Top Gun. Scott Altman did. There were two F-14 pilots primarily that flew those. So he flew those scenes. Scott Altman was my good friend, Scooter. And in the movie, if you look at the credits, they give him credit for flying the F-14 in there.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it says Scott D. Bear Altman. So he was called D. Bear. And the reason was D-Bear stood for Dancing Bear. Oh, no. Because he was a big fellow, and he would like to dance. He was great. He loved dancing to YMCA. So nice. I guess someone thought he looked like the Dancing Bear, which is also something from Captain Kangaroo, which is before your time. Uh-huh. If you know, had the Dancing Bear. And so I think the Scooter said, well, the Dancing Bear is large but not opish or something like that. So he had that, and I think he was okay with that one, but I think he preferred Scooter. So it wasn't, we had another guy named Scorch, and there's a story there that I can't tell you. Yeah. There was, so it wasn't always, you know.
I feel like it's a lot of those.
Yeah, there was one guy, yeah, I mean, yeah, it wasn't necessarily, our oldest guy was called Fossil. So it wasn't, you know, there wasn't anything with anyone called like Ace. There was no Ace. There was one guy named Ace Beal, who was a pilot out at Ellington, and we know that was a lot of baloney.
Is there a designated namer, or is it
no,
something
it
that
just naturally
comes
happens. Yeah. Sometimes. Someone will make themselves a designated namer, and it'll stick sometimes. But yeah, people just start calling you that. And
so
that's
it's dangerous then. Basically, I'm getting the sense to ask for a call name.
Don't ask for a call. No, you'll get one. And then you'll get one. Yeah, no, they can be really bad.
Yeah, all right. So. No, that's awesome. Well, Mike, I've taken up more of your time than I intended.
Yeah, but I've got to get on an airplane or else we can go all day.
Yeah, I know. And we know that countdowns are important to you. So.
Yeah, no, well, you know, the flight's going to leave with or without me, so I better get going.
No, but I appreciate it again. Appreciate you coming here to Houston and joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for spending some time with me too.
Yeah, you got to appreciate it.
All right, Rob, good luck.
All right, a huge thanks again to Mike Massimino for, you know, not only joining us in Houston but to be able to spare a few minutes, you know, as before he headed out of town to sit down and chat with us about what he's got going on and you know, share some of those stories. Just incredible to be able to chat with and you know, speak with an astronaut and someone who clearly was, you know, no pun intended, but very down to earth as an individual. So learned a lot and you know, again, appreciate his time. So as always, thank you for listening to the Independent Thinking Podcast, and we'll catch you next time.